this week, Americans prepare to mark the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, but more than 20 years later, what's the state of global terrorism?
I see it almost to the same frequency and intensity as it was on 9/11. The attacks in Africa have been horrific. They've increased in their intensity, frequency.
And as the war in Ukraine rages on, the challenges facing governments around the world to use frozen Russian assets for post-recovery efforts.
Create a strong legal framework for using these frozen assets and to make sure that there is a consensus between the United States and Europe.
Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden will observe next month's 22nd anniversary of the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil at an Alaskan military base with service members and their families. Nearly 3,000 people were killed in the attacks. Biden was a U.S. senator at the time. Former U.S. President George W. Bush, in an October 2001 televised address, announced that American forces were invading Afghanistan in what he termed carefully targeted actions, quote, designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime, end quote.
More than 2 weeks ago, I gave Taliban leaders a series of clear and specific demands. Close terrorist training camps, hand over leaders of the Al-Qaeda network, and return all foreign nationals, including American citizens, unjustly detained in your country. None of these demands were met. And now, the Taliban will pay a price.
2 years ago, the United States withdrew from Afghanistan, and the Taliban once again governed the country. Craig Albert, the graduate director of the Master in Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University, joins me to discuss global terrorism as Americans prepare to mark the anniversary. So, Craig, where I want to begin is here. Where do you see the state of terrorism on the world stage, so to speak?
I see it almost to the same frequency and intensity as it was on 9/11. And the attacks in Africa have been horrific. They've increased in their intensity, frequency. The terribleness or just awfulness of what goes on in Africa from terrorism is just sickening to study as a political scientist. And the same as Iraq and Afghanistan, the Taliban does a better job today of controlling their media image, but you know, they're still a terrorist organization and they carry out horrific events. And ISIS is once again rapidly on the rise in Iraq, really to the north of Baghdad, engaging in not just, you know, acts of terrorism, but full-scale battles again against Iraqi national forces. And so one has to look back and say, you know, what has this past 20 years done against the war on terror? And really, the U.S. and NATO allies have been maintaining a low level of resistance for terrorism and pulling out on Afghanistan and other foreign policy decisions from former President Trump and President Biden has really lessened that intensity. And now terrorism, in my opinion, is starting to get back into a higher level of intensity and frequency and sophisticated, especially if you consider their cyber caliphates that multiple terrorist actors have.
And you've actually done a lot of research in cyber warfare, cyber attacks. Can you go into a little bit more detail about terrorist organizations and their use of cyber attacks?
Yeah, absolutely. ISIS is pretty sophisticated on this. There's some controversy out there about whether Russia mimics ISIS for a lot of the cyber caliphate attacks. There's definitely some instances where it was the GRU doing it. But today we know for sure of ISIS's steady consistency, not just with attempted physical cyber attacks against national infrastructure sites throughout Iraq, their attempts to get inside DOD, U.S. Department of Defense sites and do just defacing attacks, things of that. They haven't done anything real sophisticated that's open source to the United States. But the most concerning is there, of course, propaganda campaigns on social media. And that's really where my research has been focusing a lot in the past few years. And their propaganda skills are surpass many nation state actors with what they're capable of doing. They hire cyber engineers, they hire cyber social engineers. ISIS specifically does this, and they know how to target Western states, not just to install fear in Western states, but also for recruitment purposes. They still try to recruit people from the United States, people from France, Belgium, the UK, into ISIS causes. And that's very concerning that they're still able to successfully do this. And most Westerners, most Americans particularly, don't understand that ISIS has this presence on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, and then more on the Telegram platforms.
Circling back to Afghanistan and the Taliban, you know, we just surpassed the 2-year mark where the United States withdrew from Afghanistan. And you mentioned that the Taliban government is doing a pretty good job of managing their image on social media and other online platforms. This week, the United States Afghan American Chamber of Commerce led a delegation to meet with various officials about possibly, you know, looking at business opportunities, you know, in Afghanistan. So where do you see the Taliban today, since that was the government that former President George W. Bush held accountable for giving so-called cover to al-Qaeda when it carried out the September 11th, 2001 attacks?
Their image is softer, but they are the same brutal ruling government that they were prior to 9/11. But they've gotten much more sophisticated at their PR. And so, you know, there's mixed feelings as a political scientist, you know, looking into this, what's in the best interest of the United States, which is, you know, what I try to study particularly. And, you know, there's some theories that say if you get involved with a terrorist actor that now controls the state and you try to liberalize it or incentivize it through economic connectedness, right, through interdependence, that you might be able to wield a soft power approach over them and lessen their atrocities and lessen how that authoritarian they are. And so I think that's the policy that President Biden and the U.S. right now is really trying to engage in. And there's something to be said with that. President Trump had the same idea for negotiations with North Korea, right? For negotiations with Russia, that if you engage in direct talks, you liberalize the talks, you incentivize the talks through economic channels, that you'll be able to negotiate better when it comes to high power or high politics and hard power issues. I just don't buy that, though. I think it looks good as a theoretical approach, but when you're dealing with fundamentalists, that you know, it's hard to say this, but money and economics doesn't necessarily play the same role in their strategic vision that it might for traditional nation state actors. And so you have to be careful of getting manipulated into giving terrorists the means to carry out more acts of terror, whether they're, you know, a recognized state actor or a non-state terrorist actor like al-Qaeda. And by the way, al-Qaeda is still on the rise and still looking to do things and are in talks with the Taliban again. And so the Taliban hasn't kept any of their promises for the education of women, for the role of women in society, for keeping al-Qaeda out, for not dealing with them in any way. They just in the past 2 years, they have failed in every parameter that the U.S. has set for them.
We're almost out of time, but really quickly, can you give your brief assessment of what you see the state of affairs, so to speak, on the African continent?
And the entire continent is under threat from terrorist organizations. Sahel, of course, is under threat. You have terrorist-linked organizations in Mozambique. You have them throughout the continent. This is just continuously on the rise throughout Africa. This is the area of concern. This is where most terrorist activity is on the increase, with recruiting, with type of attacks, with types of events that they're carrying out. Everything that's going on with the coups right now only encourages terrorist activities in those nation states as well.
Craig Albert is the graduate director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University. Craig, thank you very much for your time this week.
Thanks so much.
2 years ago, when the Taliban retook control of Kabul, Afghanistan's only unit of female commandos were left with a target on their backs. A group of U.S. military women helped evacuate nearly 40 of those Afghan commandos who had fought alongside them, and an American organization devoted to female veterans has helped those women transition to life in the United States. Today, as the Afghan commandos' legal statuses remain in limbo, a group called Command Purpose is using art to help release the trauma of the past while supporting their futures. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb brings us their story.
In the small town of Buda, Texas, a group of American and Afghan women are creating something new, using pieces from their past. Military uniforms, hats, headscarves are cut up and washed. Then, artist and U.S. Air Force veteran Jen Hassan runs the tiny squares of cloth through a machine known as a Hollander beater.
And that's basically a big blender for papermaking,
which pulverizes the cloth into a pulp that's either pressed into paper or used to make paintings.
This transformative process of turning clothing into paper, usually people don't believe it, you know, and so it's this magical process that they get to be part of. And I always say it's kind of like alchemy.
U.S. Army veteran Eringer Helbling says the art gathering is part of what they call Project Raha, after the Dari word for release.
It's about releasing that pain. It's about liberating and through connection, building something beautiful from something that was traumatic.
The Afghan women here served in the Afghan National Army's Female Tactical Platoon, deploying with American Special Forces to collect intelligence in areas men couldn't. Some of these American and Afghan women painting together in Buda had served together in Afghanistan. That is, until the Taliban took over 2 years ago, U.S. Army veteran Sarah Scully.
Unfortunately, that whole evacuation was, it was a mess. And so I think a lot of us felt really helpless. Like, it felt like something that was so close to our hearts, a culture and people that we loved and cared about. We were watching things just fall apart in a matter of days and hours.
When Kabul fell, Scully and other military women helped get their Afghan counterparts out of the country. It's a time that's painful to talk about for Commando Nazdana Hassani.
We lost our dream. We lost our goals. We lost everything that we did. Everything was like changed in one day. Everything.
Veteran Sarah Scully says that after 2 years, almost all of the nearly 40 female commandos who came to the United States remain in legal limbo, stuck in a backlog of asylum applicants.
They're from a country that being a woman in the military was like putting a target on your back. And the fact that some of these women still do not have asylum and some of them still have their futures up in the air and there's a big question mark of what's next is an injustice.
Hassani says she wants to know that she and her family will be safe, away from the Taliban's reach. She spent her whole life wanting to be in the Afghan military, a dream the Taliban took away. She now wants to join the U.S. Army, but she can't without a green card.
I know I'm losing the time. If I get older, I couldn't join the Army and couldn't follow my childhood dream.
Piece by piece, they place their loss, love, and hope onto canvas. The veterans support group Command Purpose will display their work in a New York art gallery in November to raise money and awareness. Katie Hopkins is the group's co-founder.
The beauty of this project is that sometimes these experiences are so hard that we don't have words to describe them and describe what we went through. And I think for these women, this art is a way for them to express the way that they feel and to remember their home together.
We made a lot of logo.
Hassani's favorite piece that she created is a small square painting that she made using pulp that was once part of her uniform. In the center of a pale pink background is a triangle made of bright red, green, and black, the colors of the Afghan flag.
Afghanistan is everything. Afghanistan is my heart.
As the old is made new, trauma is transformed, one artwork at a time. Carla Babb, VOA News.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Steve Miller. Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Ukraine. During the visit, he reaffirmed Washington's commitment to Kyiv.
To stand with you, to help ensure that you succeed militarily in dealing with the aggression, but also to stand with you to make sure that your efforts to build a strong economy and a strong democracy succeed. Because all of those things, a military that's capable of deterring and defending against further aggression, but also a strong democracy and a strong economy, are the difference between a Ukraine that survives, which it will, and a Ukraine that thrives, which it must and can. And we will be your partners in that effort.
The U.S. government and its allies are facing increasing pressure to use approximately $300 billion in Russian central bank assets that they froze not long after Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The majority of that money, more than $200 billion, is frozen in European accounts. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the European Union will present an outline of how it intends to use the proceeds for Ukraine's post-conflict recovery efforts. Now, to shed light on this complex issue and its implication for Western policymakers, VOA's Kim Lewis spoke with Charles Kupchin, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and professor of international affairs at Georgetown University in the Walsh School of Foreign Service and Department of Government. He first explained why this is a pressing issue for Western allies.
Well, even though the fighting continues and the destruction of Ukraine's infrastructure continues, it's important to begin to try to put together the funding needed to get Ukraine back up on its feet and to look for the sources of funding to rebuild the country. And we're talking about a very substantial amount of money. The bill is already close to $500 billion. It may well be closer to $1 trillion by the time the fighting ends. And I think there is a sense that Russia, morally and politically, should be the one to contribute a substantial amount of the money for the reparations. And given that it is unlikely to do so voluntarily, that's why a conversation continues about perhaps using the 300 plus billion in frozen assets that the United States, European countries, Japan, other G7 countries are now holding.
Most of Russia's frozen assets are in European countries, I understand. So will the EU be working with the United States on how to use these proceeds?
Well, I think that there are two important conditions that need to be met. One is to create a strong legal framework for using these frozen assets to rebuild Ukraine. And that legal framework is controversial. It has yet to be agreed upon. And the second is to make sure that there is a consensus between the United States and Europe, and in fact, within the G7, to go forward. Because I think one of the strong suits of NATO, of transatlantic cooperation, is that the United States and its European allies have remained in lockstep. This issue is a work in progress. There is not yet a consensus in the United States, in the European Union, in the UK, that there is a watertight legal framework to proceed with the expenditure of Russia's frozen assets for reparations. So this is a conversation that is continuing.
And given this need for a consensus, what are some of the biggest issues Western governments will have to navigate in the beginning stages of looking at these assets?
You know, I think the biggest issue is to make sure that there is a strong legal framework for proceeding. And that's because one of the strong talking points of the West when it comes to supporting Ukraine and helping it defend itself is that the West is defending a rules-based international system. And as a consequence, it needs to be able to argue that the use of Russia's frozen assets is consistent with the maintenance of that rules-based international system, and that there is a strong domestic as well as international framework for proceeding. As of yet, that legal framework has yet to be agreed upon. And then there are a couple other issues in play. One is, would the use of these frozen assets set a precedent that would encourage other countries not to hold their own assets in either euros or dollars? Could this weaken the strength of the dollar in the international system? And a second concern is the precedent that could be set. Would a signal be sent to other countries around the world that it's okay to start freezing and impounding the assets, the sovereign assets of other countries? So there's a broader legal conversation that's taking place, as well as the question of what precedents might be set.
Yes, that's a really good point. And also, you mentioned, you know, possible financial risk for these countries doing this. So is it a huge financial risk? I mean, what type of effects could we possibly be looking at?
I think that the financial risks are relatively limited if one focuses on the question of countries no longer coming to the United States with their reserve assets. The dollar has proved remarkably strong over the last several decades. Many analysts were predicting that the euro, the Chinese renminbi, other currencies would emerge to rival the dollar. That hasn't really happened. And I don't think that a use of Russia's frozen assets would undermine the strength of the dollar. For me, the biggest concern is the broader rules-based system to make sure that if the U.S. and its allies move down this road, they can make the case in the world of public opinion that this is a legally justified move. Because the bottom line here is that even though in the U.S., in Europe, there is a very strong sense of the need to support Ukraine and hold Russia accountable for war crimes and for reparations, much of the rest of the world is sitting on the fence. Most developing countries, what we call the global South, is sitting on the fence, not clearly choosing sides. And as a consequence, I think the West needs to be careful to make sure that if it proceeds down this road, it is able to make the case to Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, South Asia, Southeast Asia, that this is a move that is consistent with international law and that this strengthens the rules-based system. It doesn't weaken it.
Looking at this from a historical perspective, can the Western governments learn from, for example, U.S. Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush in their handling of Iranian government assets in 1981 and Iraqi funds in 1992?
Well, there certainly are precedents. You mentioned two important ones, the Iranian assets and Iraqi assets. I think each case needs to be looked at individually. The legal scholars who are examining this question of using Russia's frozen assets for reparations are using both of those two historical cases as they think through the complications, the pros and the cons of proceeding. As I said, even though there is a political desire on both sides of the Atlantic to move down this road, neither the American government nor the European Commission nor individual European countries have yet arrived into the comfort zone to proceed. And that's why I think this is a conversation that will continue, and we'll have to wait and see what decisions are made. There is a proposal that I've seen floating out there to at least use the profits from these Russian assets to support Ukraine. So that may be an alternative. It's not anywhere near the amount of money that we're talking about, 300 plus billion, if you include frozen assets from sanctioned oligarchs. But it is one way forward if there isn't a legal consensus or political consensus to proceed with the use of the core assets themselves.
That's Charles Kupchan, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, speaking to my colleague, Kim Lewis. Well, that's all the time we have this week. And on behalf of everyone at VOA, we thank you for listening. Join us next week for more issues in the news. And until then, I'm Steve Miller.